Accessing library computer data.
Out there, there are no saints. Just people.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the show. Continuing our run through Star Trek Deep Space Nine. Right now we're up to the episode called Rocks and Shoals. It's the second episode of the sixth season, aired on October 6th, 1997, written by Ronald D. Moore, directed by Michael Vahar. In this episode, Sisko's crew crash-land their Jem'Hadar ship into the waters of an alien ocean on a world where a group of Jem'Hadar have also crash-landed, with only one vial of Ketracel White remaining. Meanwhile, on Tarek Nor slash DS9, Kira finds that she cannot live with herself working side by side with the Dominion. We're joined by Clay. Clay, how are you?
Good. I'm happy that they gave you a little bit of a swerve in this episode by introducing not one, but two previously unseen, nameless crew members, yet they only killed one of them and not both of them.
Yeah. You talk about the crew members who were on the Defiant that show up magically in this episode. Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. Actually, I should have seen it coming because I don't think the guy had a name, but the girl, I think her name was Neely, I think, which I only remember because of, you know, hockey reasons. But but I don't think the guy had a name.
Probably didn't. He didn't really do. He had that one scene where he comes in and talks about like the doctor and Nog are missing or whatever he was saying. Whoever was Garrick and Nog are missing. So he probably didn't need a name for that. He's named in the script. I'm sure there's a lot of detail in the script about him. Let's talk about Rocks and Shoals. We're going to take a break. We're going to play an audio clip. Me and Clay are going to come back. We're going to continue with the third episode in this DS9 occupation arc. It's called Rocks and Shoals.
There are 10 Jem'Hadar soldiers on this planet, Captain. And that is the only vial of Ketracel White we have left. When it's gone, my hold over them will be broken, and they'll become nothing more than senseless, violent animals. They'll kill everyone they can. Me, you, the rest of your men, and finally turn on each other.
Why are you telling us this?
I'm ordering the Jem'Hadar to attack your base camp in the morning. But I will provide you with their precise plan of attack. You should be able to kill them all.
They're your own men.
Yes.
All right, Clay. So I'm going to start this one off. I'm going to hit you with my hot take about this episode.
I got my oven mitts on. I'm ready for it.
Not only is Rocks and Shoals a top 10 DS9 episode, I think Rocks and Shoals is a top 10 episode across all of the Star Trek series. I think it's one of the best episodes they ever did.
We're going to have a really interesting conversation then, because I did not like this episode.
Oh, really?
No, I'm just kidding. I thought it was great. Okay.
am I being overly praiseworthy in this? I think Rocks and Shoals is really almost, the way I would describe it is that like, there's like quintessential episodes for each of the series. Like if I go to TOS, I think about Corbomite Maneuver. I think about Balance of Terror. If I go to TNG, I think about like Darmok and Inner Light and things like that. I think Rocks and Shoals is one of the quintessential episodes. I would say it and Duet so far are like the two that I would say are like define the series for me. If someone were to say what's two or three episodes of this series I should watch to really get a sense about what it's all about, I would say Rocks and Shoals and Duet would be the two for DS9 so far. But I think Rocks and Shoals is one of the rare examples, like based off what we talked about last week, where we really liked the A story. We didn't like the A story with Sisko on the Defiant, but we liked the B story stuff. I think Rocks and Shoals, both storylines are that new, mature storytelling that DS9 is doing. And I think it works fantastically, but let's hear what you have to say.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think both storylines worked really well. My only wish is I kind of wish that they had given a little bit more time to Kira, sort of Kira the bureaucrat, before turning her back into a revolutionary. I know you got to get things moving and stuff, but like that was such a nice character turn for her that I wish that they had given a little bit more time than just a single or maybe two episodes of her, you know, really having to deal with that change.
Yeah.
But even so, yeah, I thought the stuff on Deep Space Nine was great. And I'm going to call it Deep Space Nine because I'm going to just keep saying Terek Noir if I try to say the other one.
That's fine. We'll keep our heads on straight.
Yeah, I thought that stuff was great. I really liked that final scene with her and Odo, where Odo is, you know, Odo is really interesting because he's kind of, I don't want to call him a coward. He's not a coward, but like he definitely, it takes a little bit to push him in the right direction sometimes.
Yeah.
Cause he is more than happy to not, rustle any feathers if he doesn't have to, and just, you know, brood about it later. But it was nice that he came around, although even, again, also maybe splitting them up even further might have been kind of interesting, but I understand why they didn't.
She's got to have some, they have to have some allies, I guess, together with each other. Yeah, she threatens him a little bit. I would say that Odo is risk-averse, I guess, would be a good way to describe him. He knows what he's doing is wrong in this situation, but he's kind of the pragmatist who doesn't have that Bajoran, you know, in Odo's mind, I think that he probably would have thought that the Bajoran freedom fighters were not fighting for, like, what, like, they didn't have a potential of winning, even though they did win. I think Odo's thing would have been like, they don't have a chance. I don't know why they're doing this, would be his perception of them. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Or at the very least, this is not the most effective way they could be voicing their displeasure or something like that.
Right. Yeah. Bide your time until you find a better situation, and then we'll go from there. Yeah.
And the stuff on the planet I thought was great. I really liked the callback to the Jem'Hadar mutiny.
I suppose.
The Jem'Hadar mutiny against Weyoun, the first Weyoun.
Yes.
I liked calling that up to try and convince the Jem'Hadar to, or if not, I mean, he was doing it to convince him, but I think it, more so it was probably a reminder for the audience that this is a possibility.
Yeah, that's true.
I thought it was great. I really liked that last standoff sequence with Sisko and the Jem'Hadar guy. It was really good. Overall, I thought it was definitely the best of the three that we've watched. It was the best, I think, so far for the season. And I would argue, it's one of the best they've probably done to this point.
I think that it, I think that works because it's fairly layered. I think actually, like the problem, to get out of the way, the worst part of this is probably the forced humor that's at the very start of it for some reason, with O'Brien saying damn about everything. Is really, really kind of awful. And then when he tears his pants, I know that the tearing his pants is supposed to be just like a, you know, kind of like they're all laughing under the stress of this thing, this journey that they're all under when they crash land on this planet, and O'Brien's upset about that. And it's kind of nice, but that scene really plays badly. I think it's so obviously people fake laughing at a situation.
I didn't mind the pants tearing as much as the damn thing. The damn thing was felt really hackneyed, but the pants thing was fine. You know, I got what they were going for.
Yeah. But once they get that out of the way, I think it all really comes together pretty well. I think that it's I guess we'll talk about the Kira and Odo scene first if we want to split them up into two stories. So the Kira and Odo thing I think is really interesting because I think it's one of the greatest examples of visual storytelling that this 90s television show has ever done. Like they, outside of the fact that Kira has to explain to the audience at the end everything that she's been feeling, I think that for the most part, the first, like her first scene where she wakes up, looks in the mirror, and then goes to work, and it's obvious that she has settled into this as the new routine, as the Dominion are all around her.
You can basically hear like ELO's Mr. Blue Sky playing in her head as she's getting up and going to work for the enemy and just super happy about it, and people are bringing her coffee and
touches like the coffee. Yeah, she thanks the Cardassian for bringing her coffee and everything, and it's just like they really, you know, it's not like 90s genre TV to not have her have a voiceover or something in that where she's like, now things aren't going so badly. I like this coffee. The Dominion have treated me nicely. I think that the visual aspect of that storytelling coupled with I feel it's one of the most effective uses of the Bajoran Vedics to this point. Like they're clearly just aping the the not Vietnamese. Was it Vietnamese? The monk, the Buddhist monk who set himself on fire. Yeah, who sets himself on fire. Like it's supposed to be that kind of a sacrifice where her suicide is supposed to drive people to action, and it does in this case. But I think that I just really love the Kira and Odo storyline because it's such a nice movement for the character. Where before we were talking about like, is the Kira character just out of gas? Well,
yeah.
Here's how you resolve that by having her basically become everything that she never wanted to be.
Yep. Yeah. This is going to sound really weird to say, but I was really happy when it turned out that the Vedic hanged herself because when she first jumped off the thing, I was like, oh, honey. That is not far enough to go to kill yourself. You're just going to like sprain your ankle or something.
you got to go head first when you go.
That was like a Michael Scott suicide attempt where he jumps off like a 3-foot ladder hoping that the fall kills him or something. I thought the change for Kira was really great. I'm kind of the suicide scene, I don't know. I didn't love it.
Oh really? Why did you think it was too I could see it being too melodramatic, maybe. Yeah, but
I think I don't know. I guess it was just the method was kind of weird. I mean, I liked the way they did it at the end, where you know the feet didn't hit the ground and the hat fell off. That was nice.
No one questions the Vedic. Like, why are you tying this noose around this thing in the middle of the promenade? I suppose.
Yeah,
it's one of those scenes. I think that the more I think about it, the less I like it. But I like it for what it is. Like as I'm watching it, I think it works. But on reflection, it maybe could have been done better. But I think it serves its purpose.
Yeah, I like the intent of it, and I like what comes out of it. But the actual scene itself, I don't know. I would have gone for something, you know, with a self-destructive phaser blast or something. I don't know. It just felt weird. I guess maybe it's just weird to see a hanging in a Star Trek show.
It is weird.
I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. With Wonder Woman's golden lasso as the news. Yeah.
But yeah, I thought the result of it with Kira's character change was great. Again, I wish, you know, my only thing I would do differently is maybe I would have stretched it out for another episode or so, but obviously they got stuff to do.
There's actually there's a little bit of trivia around that. Apparently, this in the next episode, because the writing staff had never done this kind of serialization work before, they were still having these network TV problems where the episodes had to flip order. Sometimes, like production on one had to start before the other. You're going to notice there's kind of a weirdness between this and the next episode that's due to that. But I think that they wanted to stretch out the Kira story. It's just that this one had to go first in the order.
I did notice that after this awesome episode, it's a Worf accidentally runs into his son and has to deal with that for 40 minutes, which I can't say I'm really anticipating, but hopefully it'll be good.
You can't win them all, I suppose. So that one will be an interesting one to talk about. I think that the Vedic thing, we've complained about the Bajorans being sort of bland, but I think that this is maybe the Bajoran religion being sort of bland. I think this is the best use of a bland religion you can do, where you know the Vedic is just saying like these people are evil. Evil is wrong. It's wrong to support evil. It's wrong to not do anything in the face of evil. And you know, for as dull and bland as the Bajoran culture is, that works for me. And I think that's why I think it's one of the strongest Bajoran religion sort of point or scenes or whatever, because the Bajoran religion really hasn't meant anything to this point. You've heard Kai Winn and stuff talk about, she had that great scene where she talks about like she was the one preaching the religion during the occupation, and that caused her to suffer. Like, it's not just the freedom fighters who are suffering, but this is a good sense of like why the Bajoran religion probably would have been helpful for the Bajorans to live through the Cardassian occupation, you know, as well. It's like, it's that sort of guiding reason, raison d'etre, like the reason that they continue and they struggle on against this overwhelming odds thing, and why Kira has to do it is just this religion is a big part of their culture, as rebellious, like you'll never crush us type people, even though they are very gentle and seem to get conquered at the drop of a hat. They do stand up for themselves.
Yeah, and I thought the scene with Vedic and Kira was really nice because, yeah, what she was saying wasn't horribly complex. It was pretty straightforward. But it gave a very pure contrast to Kira's kind of like tiptoeing around stuff where she's like, well, you know, I mean, it's really not the best use of blah, 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 blah. And then the Vedic's like, no, it's not the right thing to do.
Right.
And so I thought that was a nice way to cut through all of the, you know, politics of the religion stuff and just get down to what is at stake in that scene is the Vedic talking about the right thing to do in the situation versus Kira kind of not hedging her allegiance, but
trying to think. Yeah. You can waver on morality in Kira's worldview, where the religious worldview is that it's wrong at this point to be wavering on anything.
Yeah. And, you know, ultimately Kira is and has always been a religious person. So seeing the Vedic kill herself like that it makes sense that it's going to drive Kira back towards her more black and white roots, I guess you could say.
Yeah, she has a scene in this. Kira calls herself a collaborator. Did you watch the collaborator episode? I don't know if you did. It's early. Remember. It's one where Kira finds a sort of a, like they're playing off of the Nazis who fled to Argentina. They find a Bajoran who was what they called a Cardassian collaborator with the occupation. If you didn't see it, it's a nice touch on this one, because in that episode when she finds this Bajoran collaborator, she's furious at him, right? Because this is a Bajoran who sort of sold out the people and was working with the Cardassians. And the morality play of the episode is that his whole point is like, I had to kill 5 Bajorans to save 50. Like I was doing horrible things in order to try to help people. Like I had to work with the Cardassians to make them not be as vicious as they were going to be without me doing these kind of things. And Kira's just come to that point of view at this point. Like there's no, she's, we talked about in season one, her journey has been from the freedom fighter to the bureaucrat, and she becomes her utmost of a bureaucrat in this episode, I think, before bouncing back. And it's good. And I think Odo works there altogether. Odo's fittingly the malleable one. He will go with the flow or whatever needs to be done. He has a sense of justice and pride and all that. But as you were saying, he's not really... It's not cowardice, but it's more that he's willing to sort of work with the system that's in place. And he is naturally dispossessed to enjoying a sort of strong military administration like the Dominion and the Cardassians represent, even if he doesn't actually like them. And we also learned that he's being played by Weyoun. For Weyoun's reason for him being on that council is to give legitimacy to Dominion occupation of Bajor.
Yeah. You know, it's funny... I'm surprised that they don't play Odo off of Dukat more, because Odo is sort of maybe we've talked about this before, I forget. It's been a long 6 seasons. Odo is almost kind of like the inverse version of Dukat in a way, where he will work with the people who are there, even though his intentions are for the greater good. Like, That's what he's driving towards for the most part. Whereas Dukat tends to do the same thing, but for the glory of himself and for Cardassia.
Sure.
And it's not necessarily a 1-to-1, but it is an interesting mirror for those two characters in the way that they handle occupation and the way that they handle jobs that they're given in the service of larger governing bodies and stuff.
Yeah. And I guess it works to Odo's sensibility, too, because Odo kind of stays out of the way. And I think that that's important for his characterization here, where he's not really involved with Weyoun and Dukat all that much. Like, he's doing his job and everything, but he's never been one to sort of jump into that kind of leadership role. And I think that's important. I think that's important for the plot, because you can't have Odo going up there or, like, questioning why Odo is not being more involved, even though he's a founder and he should be able to boss Weyoun around and stuff like that. But I think that they're doing a good job of showing that Odo is still an outsider to even the Dominion at this point. Mm-hmm, like he's not really, Weyoun sort of plays the open hands and the downward head and everything to him. But you get a sense that there's a little bit more going on there. And Odo is not the one who's going to stir the pot, really. That's not his character.
Yeah. You know, I also really liked the scene where Jake was doing the interview with them.
Yeah.
Because I thought that was a really great, it was a good way to do quickly a scene where Kira and Odo are both basically showing their middle of the road kind of approach to things. Yeah, I like that scene a lot. And Jake is like,
and Jake's unknowingly not even getting published.
Yeah, and he's kind of like unknowingly doing this weird core hitting hardcore journalism.
Yes, yeah.
But yeah, I thought that scene was great, and which leads into, which is good to build up Kira's change in character quickly. So, you know, I guess they don't. Again, I would have liked if they spent more time on it, but the time that they do spend, I think, is very well used.
Yeah, Jake's effective. It's almost his naivete makes him an effective journalist. Like, he doesn't really understand the situation, so he just asks the obvious questions, or maybe not the obvious ones, but the ones that are, like, uncomfortable for the people in charge to answer. And I just like the fact that he's so gung-ho about it, but Wayoon is still not letting his reporting go out. Like, he's just kind of working and making people uncomfortable on the station without any greater impact outside of that. But
it would have been nice if he had, maybe this is a statement of someone who's a little bit more, or I should say less naive or something, but I was kind of hoping he would say something like, well, Wayoon's not letting my reports go out, but eventually they're going to be gone and people are going to want to know what happened here. Like, mm-hmm. like that kind of thing. But maybe that's a little bit too mature for him at this point.
Yeah. Yeah. And he's got a ways to go. He's got a few more years of journalism school in him. I like the, I think the station stuff continues the really good trend of this writing, which is like, it's just remarkably, like, I'm not going to say this is like artfully subtle in the sense of like across all television, but for like a Star Trek show of the 90s, yeah. It's relatively not heavy-handed. Like, I'm surprised. Just the visual thing I was talking about. She wakes up in the first scene, and then after the hanging, she has an identical scene, but you can clearly tell that everything has changed for her at that point. She goes, you know, she goes through the elevator. Her face is totally different. She sits down at her desk. She gets the coffee, doesn't say thank you. She walks off and all that stuff. Like, it's just a nice, subtle visual storytelling that the series hardly ever does. They do undo it at the end because they have to make sure that the audience understands everything that's been happening. But for the first 40 minutes of it, I think it works really, really well in a way that not a lot of Star Trek does to that point. And I think that the episode feels unique for a Star Trek episode because of it.
Yeah, and they let you kind of, I mean, like you said, they let the images do the work. They don't have a scene where Dukat comes in and is like, well, Major, I see that you've be acclimated very nicely to your new position, you know, that kind of shit.
Yeah, right. And she calls him his first name, whatever his first name is. I can't remember off the top of my head.
Chris, yeah. I think.
Devin.
Devin Dukat.
Yeah, so I guess we can talk about the other storyline here. I've gone on and on and on and on and on and on and on so far. Maybe not that much, but I feel like I do because I mention it a lot. I adore the Vorta race. I think that they are sublime villains for a series like this. I think that they have fantastic performances. I think that Combs as Wayoon is number one. Keevan, the Vorta in this one, is my number two favorite Vorta. Let me know what you think about this a little bit. I'm reminded of, but Keevan reminds me of Heath Ledger's Joker in Dark Knight a little bit.
Are you sure it's not Kevin?
Kevin Vorta with Kevin and Devin, which is why they couldn't have Wayoon in there. The way that he sets up the situation and his sort of detached psychopathic persona just reminds me of Ledger's Joker in a way. Like, I feel like it's somewhat similar there. It's self-serving, but he's putting people in a position where they have to make a choice about something. And he's going to come out in the end okay, no matter what happens, because he set it up this way. But he's forcing our heroes to reckon with themselves about like what, how they want to live and what it's worth to them in order to do the thing that they don't want to do.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see that. He doesn't sound quite as much like Daffy Duck like Heath Ledger's Joker does. Did you ever notice that?
My mother mentioned that. Daffy Duck, your mother mentioned it and you can't stop hearing it now?
Yeah, she mentioned it. She's like, I couldn't take him seriously. He sounds just like Daffy Duck. And ever since then, I was like, God damn it, Mom. But yeah, no, I see what you're saying. He does definitely place a choice of action in front of both Sisko and in front of the Jem'Hadar. That is really great because it forces them to make hard decisions that they could have gone another way, but they don't because of I think it's the Jem'Hadar who make the worst decision. I mean, they very easily could have. They Sisko plants the seed of mutiny, but for whatever reason, it doesn't click with this guy the way it does with the other guys. But
well, it's also tough because these, like, I think Kevin brings it up, these Jem'Hadar don't have Ketracel White. So if they mutiny, they're just going to become killing machines eventually until someone either dies or gets off the planet.
Well, Sisko gives him the option. He's like, listen, we can put you dope you up and put you in a coma and stuff. And
they never had that choice. I just love that final scene between them. It's just like what I think is that it does really well is that it's got this it's got this war and like the honor and sort of like mutual respect of soldiers at war and stuff like that. Like when they die, the last line that Sisko has is he wants a burial detail for them.
Yeah.
And I think that the other thing that it does really well is that it also continues to highlight the difference between the Dominion and the Federation and how they operate. And I think that it's really like important to keep that focus there because, the Federation values are like more ideal. You can always argue that it's kind of like, pie in the sky, wishy-washy, like utopian thing that would never actually happen. But the Federation is squaring off against basically genetic cloner slaver race of authoritarians who do these things to program these races to go and fight for them and like not think for themselves and have duplicitous little slimy businessmen named Vorta who run the whole thing. And I think it works on like just so many levels. Like the Vorta are the what Ozzy is singing about in War Pigs. He's like the politicians who send people off to die and not think about it. The bureaucrats are always the ones who survive the war while the soldiers are the ones who take the hardest hit, even if they're the more ethically correct, like in this situation. I just think it has a lot of angles on it and they all kind of work. It works in the show. It works outside of the show. It works as a symbol. It works as a plot. It works as everything.
Yeah, I think so. Definitely. And just to go back to the choice for a second. Yeah, the Jem'Hadar don't really have a choice because even though the solution that Sisko gives them is a solution, it is not one that they would ever choose because I don't know how that dude's going to go back and go like, no, everyone, put down your guns. It's fine. I know we're a warrior race who are born specifically to die in battle, but they have sweet drugs and they will just dope us up and then they will, we have to trust them with our lives essentially anyway, but we have, they're going to dope us up, drop us in a quick coma, and then, we'll be fine. I assume they'll just let us go afterwards. Or maybe we'll get our own, maybe we'll get beds. We've never had beds before.
It's a commentary on the GIs who got hooked up on opium and heroin in Vietnam and then came back and were clean and everything like that. There's always the argument against addiction because that's used as the example where so many people in Vietnam were using heroin and opium and came back and were able to quit it easily.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
It's just the science of it seems to imply that addiction is more than just the like neurophysiological approach to a drug, like there's like societal impact and everything like that. I think that the Jem'Hadar, the flip side of the Jem'Hadar argument would be like if the Jem'Hadar had offered Sisko, you guys come with us, we're going to clone you and genetically manipulate your offspring to be subservient to us, but you'll survive. That'll be the okay. Our heroes wouldn't really go along with that, I guess, and the Jem'Hadar can't go along with an offer of being put into a coma and allowed to wake up later.
Yeah. Do they ever, is there ever a plot line where they've discovered, the Starfleet has discovered a, not a cure, but like
a synthetic.
Or a way to get them off of the Ketracel White so they wouldn't have to be subservient? Or did they already do that?
I think they've talked about it. I think they've talked about it in a past episode as being an option as to what they would do. I don't think that ever becomes a thing going down the line.
I'm surprised. That seems like something you would do in like the seventh season of a show when you're running out of, that seems like the, all of, we have Chris Borg here, who who can think for himself. Now we can get him to get everybody else to think for that. You know what I mean? Like, we've run out of ideas for this race.
No, I think the Ketchicell is just supposed to be like the Arby's sauce. Like, no one knows how to make this, and so they're hooked on that horsey sauce, I think, at this point. Looks like horsey sauce, I guess. I think that the variety of the Vorta is interesting because it's kind of like the Vulcans, and it's less like the Ferengi and the Klingons in that you can have totally different personalities, but both of them are still very Vorta. Like, Weyoun and Keevan are both very different people from each other, but you can see how their characterization as a race would allow for both of them to exist in a different way. Like, they're both effective at being what a Vorta needs to be.
Yeah, it's funny, too, because I feel like there are fewer races that are like that than there are... It seems like every time they introduce a new antagonistic race, it's just sort of like a step to the left or right of Klingon.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, even the Romulans, they look like Vulcans, but they're kind of like Klingons. The Jem'Hadar, they're kind of like Klingons, except they're more intense. The Founders are not, and the Vorta are definitely not. The Vorta are definitely more like a Vulcan inclined. It's like if the Vulcans went evil, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
But no, it's not even that. It's not that much of a one-to-one, but they do skew more that way. And it does make for a better villain, because they are, they're a lot more, they're a lot smarter, I guess, flat out, than a lot of the other ones are. And they present problems that you can't just shoot your way out of. And
there's a flexibility to their planning, I guess, is the way. I think the Vorta would become old if they were all kind of like the Combs performance at a certain point. Yeah. I think his performance informed what they were supposed to be, but you can be, as I said here, the Heath Ledger version of Weyoun, and it still feels like it's a Vorta that you're dealing with.
Yeah.
Or if you did that for a Klingon, you'd feel weird about it. Sorry.
You can get Sisko and the Jem'Hadar guy together, and he'd be like, all right, we're going to have tryouts.
You have nothing. I think that the war storyline is good. I actually, it's funny, you mentioned before on one of the previous episodes, I've been like, when, if you were watching this in real time, would you start to feel that you were in a serialized story for DS9? Mm-hmm. I felt it here.
Yeah, definitely.
I even like the opening thing where the ship crashes on the planet. I like that shot of Garak looking out using his little virtual boy headset to see the planet coming, and then the ship crashing down on the planet and everything.
I think I've asked this before. Does Garak ever blink? I don't think that he blinks. I think he purposely plays him so his eyes are constantly open, because his eyes are so wide open all the time, and he has the way that he acts with him is very much based on head movement and eye opening, how wide his eyes are open.
Mm, yeah.
Like his eyes are always very wide, and his head is kind of tipped back, and he does a lot of head turning and stuff. I don't know if I've ever seen Garak blink.
And you think it's a choice? I don't remember.
I do. I think it's a very interesting choice.
I don't remember Andrew Robinson in Hellraiser or anything. If he blinked, I can't actually remember if that was a thing or not.
Well, I mean, that's what's great about his portrayal of the character is he clearly has a take on this guy that is very different from most other Cardassians. You know, a lot of them outside of Dukat, really. I don't know if I would really say the actors are bringing anything unique to the portrayal of Cardassians, you know?
They're just Klingons. They're just the Klingon character.
Yeah, even if you get that far. But, you know, at a certain point, it's just like, what's Garak's buddy there, the one who died in prison a couple what? Last season?
An Albert Tain.
Yeah, like that guy, he's just an old guy with prosthetics on his face. He's not doing anything interesting. He's just doing the lines, acting the lines, but he's not making, you know, choices that scream, I am a Cardassian, or I am really into this character. Whereas Garak he makes some choices, and he is great.
He wrote a book. He wrote a fan fiction about Garak. Not fan fiction. He wrote a book about the character. Apparently, while he was shooting, he would like sort of journal or write a diary as if he were Garak. And at the end of the production, he turned it into a book.
That's fun. Have you read it? Is it any good?
No, it's apparently one of the best Star Trek novels, though, of all of them. I have never read it because I don't like the Star Trek novels, but maybe I'll make an exception for that one. The other thing about the storyline, I think, is that it's starting to show the wear and tear of the war. I know that we've only been at the war for a couple episodes, and maybe you could make a negative point of just saying that it feels like everything is kind of flying by. Like Kira's turn and everything, it feels like everything's happening very suddenly. I think it's managing an okay setup for it. And I think that I think that the ultimate choice that Sisko has to make here shows how far the war will bend Federation values. He has some line here about it's either us or them at one point, which is probably, I would say, the opposite of what the Federation values are. Like in any other Star Trek episode, you wouldn't say Starfleet represents it's either us or them at the end of the day. And I think it's all believable. And I think that Starfleet, and I think that the ending scene does a really good job of selling how, even though this was the thing that they had to do, they feel terrible about it, and that's why they will never be. That's why they will never be the Joker. That's why they will never be the Vorta in this case. They will never fully embrace this kind of like shenanigans or cowardice, I guess you could say, to keep their own survival going.
Yeah,
and I just think it's nice. I think it's a pretty emotionally satisfying episode, I guess would how I'd describe it. I think that everything, it ends on kind of a bittersweet note, but it feels really good. All the decisions make a lot of sense. And I think that I feel for the Jem'Hadar in this. It's they did a good job of humanizing them while also villainizing the Vorta even more at the same time.
Yeah, I think what they do well in this show is they tend to press on the values of Starfleet by putting them in very non-Starfleet situations. For instance, in this episode, you've got, you're putting Starfleet ideals in the context of your crew members are dying, you're trapped on a desert planet, and you have someone that's coming to kill you. And it's not a very Starfleet kind of situation. It's not, there's no option to,
talk your way out of it or anything.
Yeah, there's no option to talk your way out of it or like set the ship to self-destruct and then beam off to another ship or something like that. It's a very like ground and pound, coin flip, situation. And I think running the Starfleet values and the Starfleet characters through that ringer really makes it interesting because it puts pressure on the ideas that in a way that you don't find that often. You know, like even in TNG when they have to do stuff, it doesn't usually ever get this intense. But when they do have to do stuff like this, there's always, the Enterprise is always just in orbit or something, there's always that thing that helps them have to, that allows them to fall back on the core of the Starfleet thing without sacrificing anything. Whereas here they don't have that. So they have to figure out how do we maintain our, morality, but also get out of here without getting killed.
Yeah. And I think that I would say that they compromise their morality here. Like they do what they have to do. They do kill the Jem'Hadar. Like they have to do that to do it, but it's not no one feels good about it at the end, I guess. Like it's one of those, it's just a nice spin on the war storyline there. And I think that putting them, as you said, I think it's a good point that put them in a situation where there is no narrative safety blanket that they can get back to. And they're totally isolated. They're on this planet. The Jem'Hadar are going to go crazy and kill them either way. So you got to do this or you got to do that. And it is effective. I think that it's sort of what separates DS9 from TNG, I would argue. Yeah. Like there's a little bit of a separation between the characters and the sort of safety of being on a ship that can save you and things like that, or being able to talk your way out of it. The Enterprise, if this were a TNG episode, they would be in the middle of two combating sides going at it, and they would be the mediator between them. So they're not doing the killing. They're trying to stop the killing, but they're not actively involved in the killing.
Yeah. And I also liked, and this is kind of a split off thing anyway. I was going to ask you, are you surprised that they didn't have anybody take a shot at the Vorta at the end? Because I liked the way that they played it with Sisko was like really pissed off that he had to do that. And for a second, you kind of thought maybe he's going to kill this guy.
He cocks his gun at him. He does point his gun at him, yeah.
I was a little bit surprised that they didn't have somebody else do it. But I think it was a downer enough of an ending as it was that I don't think you needed, you know, Ensign Neely or whoever just taking a shot at the
That would have been the problem. It would have been a character that we don't know. You know what I mean? It would have been the ensign who survived would have just popped him in the head and been like, and Sisko would have had to reprimand her or something.
The other thing I was going to say off of that was I feel like I really like that they make the decisions specifically limited to one person on Starfleet's side. And so they didn't have this like running thread through it where one of those two disposable characters is like the sounding board for why they should just kill everybody, you know? They keep the choices that have to be made inside the bubble of the choice itself and who the choice is given to. And there's not like a scene where, you know, O'Brien is talking about how much these people are garbage or something. It's very much between Sisko and Jem'Hadar guy. I forget.
Yeah. Kamalatakan or something like that. I forget his name.
He's dead. It doesn't matter. But you know, I think that shows a little bit more maturity too, because I think traditionally in a Star Trek show, you would have that character where if you saw a character show up randomly who you've never seen before, he's going to have either he's just going to be expendable, or he's going to have that sort of role where he's like the one who's wants to just wipe them all out regardless of order or whatever like that.
I think that there's two things. So the not killing Keevan at the end, I think, is just another point of the Heath Ledger thing. Like Sisko's saying, I have one rule in that moment.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that works. I think killing him would have been understandable on one level, but I think that that's not the way the story needs to go. Like, I think that the Keevan playing the Federation for what they are, knowing that he'll survive by doing this, I think is more evil on his end and more morally compromising for our folks, where you're like, they can't really kill this guy, even though he is the slimiest Star Trek character we've seen to this point. And I think that as to your other point, they have that scene in the cave where they're trying to figure out what they're doing, and they kind of broach the subject of other people chiming in, but Sisko says this is not a democracy, and there's only one opinion that matters.
Yeah,
I see that as even further. That's really hammering home the point that even though that totally makes sense because he's the captain and they're all subordinate to him, it's really just showing that the Federation values of let's talk it out aren't working in this situation. There is no talk it out solution where we all get together and we all have a vote and, you know, the people with the best idea or the people with the happiest idea sort of come out of it. Sisko realizes that he has to shut down the conversation and just do what needs to be done.
Yeah. And I mean, they also get a short scene, after Sisko meets with the Jem'Hadar guy, because they just bring him right into the Batcave for some reason. I'm not sure why they did that. So now they know exactly what their position is. But after he leaves, he has a short scene with Dax that I feel like is kind of, it's one of those things where I think you easily could have had Dax be the angel on the shoulder or something. But even Dax is kind of like, well, you know, this is going to suck, but something's going to happen, you know? Which I liked. And also, she was believably hurt. she wasn't spouting deathbed wisdom for like 15 minutes at a time.
The actress has a severe skin sensitivity to the sun. That's the whole reason that Dax gets injured in this episode.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah. Yeah. Huh. So she can't go out into the sun.
They didn't want to have Dax have like a parasol.
you're having this dramatic scene between Sisko and the Jem'Hadar, and it cuts to a close up of Dax, and she's just sunburnt, like she's just like beet red. It's extremely distracting about it.
Dax, I didn't realize that we had crashed on a planet that is well known to be very violent towards your kind, which is why you wear this giant hat and sunglasses to hide your face.
All we have on this planet to eat are tomatoes. Everyone, dig into these tomatoes. do you have anything else you want to talk about this one, or should we just go to final thoughts?
No, I think we pretty much hit everything.
All right, let's take a break. I'm going to play an audio clip. Me and Clay are going to come back. We'll read some patron thoughts, and then we'll give our final thoughts about rocks and shoals.
It was obvious that approaching your position from this canyon was a deliberate tactical error on his part.
You knew?
I suspected. Despite what Kievan may think, the Jem'Hadar are often one step ahead of the Vorta.
You can still stay one step ahead. Surrender.
I have my orders.
Kievan doesn't deserve the unwavering loyalty you're giving him.
He does not have to earn my loyalty, Captain. He has had it from the moment I was conceived. I am a Jem'Hadar. He is a Vorta. It is the order of things.
Do you really want to give up your life for the order of things?
It is not my life to give up, Captain. And it never was.
All right, everybody. So, if you're interested in supporting the show, you go to patreon.com/thepenskyfile. A couple dollars a month, you get extra stuff. You get podcasts. You get the ability to comment on upcoming Star Trek episodes like this one. And if you had joined by June 5th, which you can't do now, you could have heard us talk about the Orville, but we'll do other special offers going forward in the future. And right now, let's head to our patron thoughts for Rocks and Shoals.
How does that work? Like, is it only the people who signed up by a certain time? So, like, if you add money, you can't retroactively listen to that? Is that how it works?
Yeah, because the other podcast on Patreon, if you become a patron, you can go back and listen to everything that's already there.
But the Orville one, you cannot.
The Orville one, right. I did not post it publicly. I just messaged everyone who was a patron on June 5th, and they all got the message with the link to the audio, but it's not public anywhere.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. Yep. Rocks and Shoals, Andrew Cherlog. We get another glimpse of the honor of the Jem'Hadar versus the dishonor of the Vorta. Good episode overall, but no real danger as there are plenty of red shirts to give us the needed deaths in the episode. Good, but not great. Zam Nuclear
Vessel. I believe they're gold shirts in Deep Space Nine.
Yeah, they are, right? The gold collars, I think, with the new uniforms. Zam Nuclear Wessel says, Rocks and Shoals, my second favorite episode of the series. The A-plot is an improved version of the ship, with that very ship now at the bottom of a lake, but the B-plot is like nothing else in Star Trek. Kira's daily cycle is very simple, but the simplicity means that subtle changes deliver big messages. I think that's well said. Stephen Cobb, Rocks and Shoals, like top three episode of DS9. First off, Kira's morning routine initially established what was going on. Then after the suicide, she looks up from her coffee and realizes that she only sees Cardassians and Jem'Hadar. Brilliant moment. It was earned because it was built up. The scene between Odo and Kira really is super in character. Go down. What is going on here? Skip the back way that, up.
The way that that was phrased, it made me think like she was carrying her coffee as the woman was killing herself. And then she was just like... taking a sip of her coffee. Oh, shit. That sucks.
It's the coffee take. Zam Nuclear Wessel adds on to Rocks and Shoals. When Kievan shows up at the end carrying his bag, I think of the Godfather saying, one man with a briefcase can steal more than 100 men with guns. Will Yates. Great episode that reminds me of the tragedy of World War I, how the soldiers understood each other in a way that their callous leaders never could. The almost fanatic devotion to a pointless cause despite knowing the folly of it. Even the gallows humor from O'Brien on the beach, which looked a lot like Gallipoli, I guess. I might be mispronouncing.
Gallipoli.
There you go. My ignorance shone through like a beacon. More great character development for Nog. And I think this is Philip Morris's best Star Trek work, but Kira steals the show, even with so little time on screen. A lot of love for the Kira stuff, actually. I think that's great.
It's really good.
Yeah, I sort of prefer the Sisko stuff, but I think that the Kira stuff is really good.
I think it's just that the Kira stuff is so unique for Star Trek. You know, I mean, the Sisko stuff is great, but big picture, it's not that different.
Not that different, yeah.
You know, from any other stuck on a planet or whatever. Like it is, but it isn't. You know what I mean?
Yeah. What would you say is what's the difference about Kira? I'm just so you can clarify. I think I know what you're talking about. Like, why is Kira unique in this storyline?
Well, because first of all, she's not a Starfleet character. She is a character who exists in a secondary role to what is traditionally a Star Trek, you know, story, and which allows her to this natural gray area anyway, and also the actual story that's being told with her is one of a pretty huge character turn. Maybe it's a, is it a circle? I don't know. Mm-hmm. But you know, she goes from terrorist to someone who works for the betterment of the greater good, and then ends up as a what was the word from the that she uses?
Oh, collaborator.
A collaborator, only to come back to where she was at the beginning. It's the natural kind of progression of like the hero's journey kind of thing, where she ends up coming back to where she started, but she's changed now.
Yeah.
And I think that dark story that they're telling with her is something that is very unique to Deep Space Nine.
Yeah.
Because you don't have any characters. What's another character from another Star Trek show before this that would have a story like this? I mean, the closest you would get is maybe Picard being tortured by the Cardassians, but even there, it's still, you know, you've got this anchor of Starfleet and the quote unquote Star Trek character that is supporting everything. And you know, that's a pretty straight black and white good versus evil kind of thing, even if the ending is a little bit gray. But here you've got a character who is unique to this show being put through a very unique character arc, and it's just really great.
Yeah, I'd agree. Kyle Barrett says, Rocks and Shoals, I love this episode. The Sisko plot is great, and I enjoy how he and the Vorta try and manipulate the Jem'Hadar for their own gains, and we have a greater understanding of the Vorta and Jem'Hadar species once it's over. I also like what they do with Kira and the dialogue-free scenes of her waking up and looking into the mirror, and then later surveying ops and seeing nothing but Cardassians and Dominion. Of course, this is still 90s Trek, so she later explains exactly what she's thinking to Odo, but those moments were great. It shows how the series is developing and trying new things, not just in the unprecedented overarching serialized narrative, but in the little moments, too. Yarpy says, A bit surprising episode to put as the second episode of the season. Nicely shows the folly of blind obedience and following orders. The scenes set in DS9 show the character development with Kira. First season Kira wouldn't have been so diplomatic with the Dominion, and especially not with the Cardassians. Matt Ross? Feels a little bit like Hippocratic Oath from the running out of Ketracel White. Yes, another episode where we see that mindless killing machines, the Jem'Hadar, are smarter and more with it than they are supposed to be. What a weakness. Without the drug or able to locally synthesize, their supply lines are crazy. Anyway, the cursing here is nicer than on other shows and mild. The crashing on the planet was exciting. The duplicitous nature of the Vorta devilishly pragmatic. Although you know our heroes will still make it, the ride to get there is still fun. And Rocks and Shoals, Christian Pouch says, one of my favorite episodes of all of DS9, Ramadaclan, that's the name of the Jem'Hadar, is my favorite Jem'Hadar, and nobody embodies the essence of the Jem'Hadar like him. They have their own bizarre sense of honor, and they don't give a shit about politics, but that's not to say that they understand some of politics. His end, and the end of his men, is particularly tragic. A superb performance from Phil Morris, who also played a kid in the TOS episode Miri, and a cadet in Search for Spock. Keevan is also a great Vorta, a bureaucrat who doesn't give a shit about his own men, only himself. The physical location we've seen 100 times before, but I think this episode really takes advantage of the space, spreading out the involved parties over a vast area, and has them fighting at much more realistic distances. This is a 5 out of 5 for me. And then the last one, that's it. That's actually it. I would say that the one maybe major weakness, I think, and on the fighting over vast area, the Jem'Hadar, who are this like fearsome warrior species, and the Federation, which is basically a military organization. Everyone, when they're moving between areas, just gets out into the middle of an open plain with no cover and walks around. They don't walk through the mountains or anything on the sides. They walk right through the valley where everyone can look down at them. Yeah.
When Keevan was like, I'm giving you their location and their exact battle plan, and it's like hard cut to just 5 guys in a row walking very close to each other. Like, and they're these amazing warriors, but they move like the hot cops in Arrested Development when they're trying to pretend to be real cops. And it just feels like it's a bunch of dudes in costume walking through the desert with toy guns, you know?
That's it. Thank you, patrons. And also, the Captain Tier gets a shout-out at this point. So if you're a Captain Tier supporter on Patreon, I'd like to thank you all personally. It's Andrew Cherlog, Ben Douglas, Bradley Killens, Captain Quark, Cardinal Doomsday, Christian Pouch, David K, Dwayne Hackett, Eric Johnson, Yarpy, Joint Mango, Kevin Reyes, Kyle Barrett, Matt Flores, Matt Cutler, Matt Ross, Mike Burnett, Nathan Elliott, Neil Brennan, Nick Sergi, Robert Cummins, Russell Elledge, Samuel Custer, Grim Santo, Sean Spinobi, Stephen Cobb, Tarek Lateef, and Will Yates. Thank you very much for supporting the show. It's much appreciated. All right, Clay, final thoughts about Rocks and Shoals. You want to go first on a scale of 1 to 5? What are you going to give this guy?
I'm going to give it a 5. I thought it was great. Yeah, I think for all the reasons we talked about before. My one question, though, it would be interesting if anybody would know the answer to this. Should it be harder or easier to miss shooting a phaser?
Because it'd be easier, I think. I would point it like a laser pointer and just strafe the area with everything.
Yeah, I guess because like I'm watching them shoot from the mountains, and I'm like, well, you've got like an unbroken beam coming for your thing. I feel like it should be really easy to kill people with this thing, but they keep missing. Whereas the Jem'Hadar are using like actual like burst shooting guns.
Yes, yeah,
so
that's
I can
true.
See why they would miss, even though they're supposed to be like the amazing fighters. But whatever. Yeah, I'd be curious to see whether or not it's easier or harder to hit something with a phaser.
I think that they the accuracy when they're killing them all at the end is pretty high. They go like 5 for 5 with their final shots. They kill all the Jem'Hadar. Yeah. Like they don't really miss at that point. But yeah, I would.
There was someone who shot one of those guys after he was already on the ground, and I was like, "Ooh, shit, that's cold, man."
That was the
Ensign Neely taking an extra shot at the guy after he's down.
It was the last shot of that guy who died up in Bashir was tending to him. His shot was a little bit off. He shot that guy in the foot. Yeah, I'm going to give this one a 5 as well. Again, I think it's one of the it's a top 10 Star Trek episode for me, actually. In DS9, it's much higher than that, but I think it's definitely one of DS9's best. I think that it works on pretty much all cylinders. It's just nicely subtle. You just see the differentiation between this and what the previous TNG and previous DS9 even was. Like they're still kind of telling you what the themes are, but I feel like the things are layered in a lot more, where they're not bringing up all of the obvious comparisons there. You can draw them yourselves as a viewer and realize what you think you're watching and like what it symbolizes and stuff like that. I think it's really good. I think it's a great episode of Star Trek. It's pretty strong indeed. 5 for me.
Yeah, for one that's so heavy with morality, though, I'm surprised the title isn't like 8 lines from a Shakespeare play or something.
Right. Yes. Yeah, they don't do that. Do you know what rocks and shoals are, actually?
No idea. Well, I mean, I'm aware of the concept of rocks, but I'm not sure what shoals are.
It's what the naval like justice system was called. It's the nickname for whatever sort of legal thing that the Navy has. It's part of their charter or something. No ship stuck between rocks and shoals or something is the line. So,
So it's in the same wheelhouse where it's like the last third of a longer statement.
Yes, it's taken from another statement and it's a part of it. But it's a pretty good title, I think. I like it. That's it. Guys, thank you very much for listening. Thank you for supporting the show. You can follow all the social media down below, Facebook, Twitter, Discord. Come to the Discord if you want to have a little chat. Support the show on patreon.com/thepenskyfile. A couple of dollars a month, you get extra stuff. You can also do the PayPal link, and you can buy t-shirts at the Teespring link down below. Clay, do you have anything you want to say?
Yeah, I'm going to put this out there because if I don't, then it won't be real. But next month, July, I'm going to be running a Kickstarter for a book that I'm going to be, a comic book that I'm going to be writing and drawing called Bloody Hell. And, as that gets closer to launching, you will get more information, but keep your eyes open for that.
Cool. Do you have any more information you can use to whet the whistle of this?
Well,
like, is there an elevator pitch?
The elevator pitch is it's about 5 mystically powered Viking warriors who've been imprisoned for 1,000 years, and then they're let loose when their prison's destroyed by an artillery shell from World War I. So then they're let loose all juiced up on magic, and they start tearing ass during the First World War. And it gets into some of the more grayer elements of World War I, but there's monsters and there's Vikings, and it's kind of like a fantasy horror thing.
So it's exactly what the next episode of DS9 is all about, is what you're saying?
Is that what the next episode is about?
Worf's son is a zombie Viking.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, yes. Yes. So if you like that episode, you will love this book.
Yeah, guys, we'll have more information about the Kickstarter as it approaches. When it comes out, you'll be hearing the plug on the show, obviously, and then on the social networks. I think that's it. We're done with Rocks and Shoals. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you next time.